The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to merckresearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now, on to today's episode. I am here with Shayna Sissel of Spotlight Asset Group. Thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. Okay. Very honored to have you on this show. You are the CIO of the Spotlight Asset Group, right?
That is correct.
Also a fellow podcaster. Don't get too many of those on here. You recently started the Black Swans podcast, which I listen to maybe not all the time, but very frequently.
Well, awesome. I'm glad to hear that.
Probably shouldn't admit that I don't always listen to it, but anyway.
Okay. You can catch up on the episodes.
Yeah. But anyway, so we'll talk about that later. But the reason that I wanted to have you on the show, because you have some views here on specifically tech stocks. And this is a segment of the market that we all know has been overbought, or at least that's kind of the narrative that has emerged now over the last couple of weeks. In March and late February, there was quite a bit of selling in these names. They have since rebounded. Yes. Nevertheless, one could certainly still surmise that these tech stocks are certainly very rich in their valuations, that this is perhaps not the time to buy shares of these companies. And you have a view that is a little bit different. So Tell me what it is.
So I'm not quite Cathie Wood different in my view on tech stocks. However, I don't believe one of the things we've seen, and this has been true since probably last summer, where we started to see this start to happen, is that as we've become more and more confident in the pandemic ending and the reopening of at least the U.S. economy, like I don't have as much confidence in the global economy at the moment, but the U.S. economy reopening is pretty close at this point, with 22% of the population having received at least one dose of the vaccine and several states opening up vaccination to the entire adult population, Mississippi and Wyoming most recently, following Alaska. It's all really good news for the reopening and sort of accelerates what we already kind of expected to be a midsummer reopening. People have decided that as a result, a lot of the tech stocks that worked throughout the pandemic aren't as attractive. And they've shifted to these value stocks, which made sense. They were super beaten up. And then, and a lot of them fundamentally made sense, and cyclicals as well. You know, most people don't understand this fact. And I think it's really important for people to understand this. And I've seen very prominent people on Twitter in our industry not understand this. But cyclical stocks, so energy, industrials, materials, have extraordinarily high PEs at their bottom. Why? Because their profitability is entirely based on a cycle, and they make the least amount of profits when their cycle is bottoming, right? Mm-hmm. That's just how cyclicals work. If you talk to any deep value manager, you look at their portfolio when cyclicals are bottoming, it looks super expensive. But it's because cyclicals have their least amount of earnings when their cycle is at the bottom of the cycle, and hence their PE looks super expensive. It's the only, that's a very specific to cyclicals. So they looked expensive in the market and make, they make the market look expensive when that happens. So it actually made sense to see that kind of shift for a variety of different reasons, as, you know, a economy that's rebounding is benefiting in a cycle, and the cycle will start to rebound as well. So there's that. But that doesn't mean that the tech stocks aren't still attractive to me. So here's the thing, and I talk about this a lot. Are our tech stocks expensive? Yes, but tech stocks and growth stocks, stocks that have higher than average growth. And when you say higher than average growth, most people think that means than the market, but it actually means more times than not the economy. And so you're, you know, these stocks all have above average growth rates, and people pay a premium for that, right? Because you're worried about future earnings, not current earnings. And if your growth rates are higher than the economy, then your future earnings will grow faster. And so you're pricing and you're assuming what your upside is based on future earnings, not current earnings. And PEs typically only reflect either current or only a year out, right?
Right.
So they always trade at a premium. And I would argue they always should.
Now, that doesn't mean that some of the growth, and I guess this is maybe part of the calculus when it comes to these growth stocks, especially the ones that have benefited from the coronavirus crisis. You know, like we're recording this on Zoom. Where was Zoom a year ago?
Right.
I don't even know, but it's several multiples of that now.
Right.
Now, obviously, we can't expect that kind of growth for a company like Zoom, or can we?
So I think people think that there isn't much growth for Zoom after the pandemic, but I would argue that long-term trends that, and many of which have been accelerated because of the pandemic, actually suggest that growth will be better than people expect. Will it be as fast or as strong as it was during the pandemic as people had to, were forced adoption? Probably not.
Right.
But many people are suggesting that we'll have almost no growth in the future. And I think that that's a mistake. And the reason I think that's a mistake is because one of the trends we saw during the pandemic, this work from home, is not going away. I think
don't tell David Solomon. No, go on.
Well, there are certainly companies that, that want to have people back. But I think, you know, prior to the pandemic, working from home was frowned upon. People were afraid to, even if they had flex time, they were afraid to use it because they were afraid of how it looks. In a way, the pandemic normalized working from home, right? People realized I can be super efficient, and companies couldn't say, well, you're not, you don't work as hard when you work from home. Because he did it for a year and we did fine. So don't tell me I can't be productive from home when you know I just spent a year being super productive. So employees who were also reluctant to take it, that were forced, realized there's some benefit. And there have been plenty of studies across the world. One of the more well-known ones was done in China, that would show that once people have worked from home for an extended period of time, they do want to go back to the office. So they don't want to go back permanently. They like having the flex. And I think you'll see more of that. Mm-hmm. And that just increases the need for and the demand for things like Zoom. Mm-hmm. There's going to be industry consolidation, and the trend is there. Mm-hmm. But Zoom isn't necessarily one of the tech stocks that I'm super bullish on.
Okay.
I'm looking at things that are like longer term trends. So okay. Like my favorite names are in things that benefit from trends today and tomorrow. So NVIDIA is a stock that I have loved for most of my career, actually. And I started following the stock in 2002 or three, when it was a fairly new player and it was just a graphic interface semi that was starting to have mass adoption in video games. And then every computer had a NVIDIA graphic chip. And that's still the case. But what NVIDIA also benefits from is it's the number one chip maker in any sort of automated self-driving cars. Anything that's an automated AI-oriented uses NVIDIA for their chip. And there's not a lot of players that compete with them. They're so far ahead of the game because they've been doing it now for almost two decades. And so they're the dominant player in the space and they have the dominant technology. And that is a tailwind for them going forward because longer term trends benefit a stock like NVIDIA. Mm. There's firms like Marvell Technologies, which is big on 5G. That again is a tailwind. Now, these are all stocks that still did well during the pandemic because they had technologies that benefited from the work from home trend. But I think a lot of people fail to see that they still have long term tailwinds that are beneficial. And we just had Congress pass this talking about passing an infrastructure bill. And firms like Marvell Technology benefit from an infrastructure bill where part of any type of infrastructure improvement is going to involve improved internet access, improved fiber optics. And Marvell is a company that would benefit from that. You look at Activision Blizzard, which is another company I like. Everybody's like, oh, it's gaming, you know, gaming is becoming almost normalized to some extent. Here in Chicago, they're building an arena specifically for watching gaming events. That is a trend that I think will continue. Mm. And again, you have a leading player in that space with great market share, a great moat, and so on and so forth. Mm. So I look at names where I think that there are longer term trends beyond, you know, just like something like Zoom, where we're talking about just benefiting from work from home. And I still think that Zoom has some growth, but that's not one of the stocks I'm really heavy on. My point when I say I still like tech is that I think to say that tech's out of favor or tech's too expensive or you shouldn't buy tech because it's overpriced ignores the fact that there are long-term trends there. And all of the tech names to date have been really killing their earnings estimates, right? And so your PE is only as good as your estimate. And if your E estimate's wrong, Will Danoff used to say this, I remember this because Will was one of the only institutional investors that attended the Google Roadshow before Google went public. Hmm. And everybody wanted to know why he would invest in Google. And his big thing was PE only matters if you get the E right. Hmm. And people don't have the E right here. Hmm. And he was right. And it was a big win for him. But yeah, I mean, PE is a great fundamental factor for looking at valuation, but you got to look at the whole picture.
Of course.
And one of the things people tend to ignore is you can have a high PE if your cash flow growth is really strong. Mm. So you look at something like Tesla, who's got a super expensive PE, and the cash flows aren't great. They're deteriorating. So that, to me, is a red flag. So I'm okay with investing in a stock that looks expensive from price to earnings if their cash flow growth is extremely strong. Okay. And if I think the E is being used to calculate my PE is wrong. If my E is different, then maybe, to me, it isn't that expensive if you've done the work.
Fair enough. So that begs the question, do you have any kind of idea of fair valuation for the stocks that you mentioned? Or what? Yeah.
I think fair value is, you know, based on your own calculation. Now, in the case of NVIDIA, have I calculated a target price? No. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at growth potential and looking at the fundamentals. But I haven't necessarily looked at target prices. Now I've looked at analyst target prices and I can tell you what the consensus is and whether or not I think it's too low. And I think in many cases it is, but if we've learned nothing, a lot of these target prices are irrelevant. It's funny because we did a podcast interview yesterday with Dominique Millet, who's a former hedge fund manager. And we were talking about this very thing. And she said, you know, a lot of people look at something like GameStop and think, well, based on, you know, do your DCF model, like this is, it's a $20. This stock's worth $20, right?
Right.
But what people don't realize is sometimes the gamification of, say, a GameStop or AMC is probably a better example, can allow the company to do things with their capital structure to make changes that suddenly make them worth a lot more money. So in the case of AMC, because their stock got bid up, they were able to convert some convertible notes, change their capital structure, take their leverage down so they could fight to see another day to make it through the pandemic. And then suddenly they're a completely different stock once the movie theaters can reopen, right?
Right.
The question was, would they make it that far? GameStop, for example, I don't know if I agree with this thesis, but you could argue. Has been given a lifeline to some extent because their stock's at 209. They can raise capital. They can, you know, change some of their leverage. And potentially, if they have good management and they want to make good decisions, make some changes to their strategy to allow them to change enough to survive. And what's happening in GameStop is giving them that opportunity. Now, will it happen? Will it not? Who knows? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But if a stock, because of activity in the capital markets or in the stock market, can live another day to be given the chance to avoid a bankruptcy filing, they have more time to try to fix their company to make it survive. And GameStop's been given that opportunity. AMC was given that opportunity. And so that is always a factor you have to consider when you're looking at these stocks and you're making price targets. It's no a question. Fluid process. And every firm I've ever worked through at that did calculate target prices will tell you that like every new piece of information means you have to recalculate that price.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, having said that, I mean, GameStop does require people to go come into ultimately to come into their stores and buy video games in person, right? They don't have
currently, but I'm not, no idea what the shift would be, but there's apparently some way potentially they could shift their business to be more of like a cloud provider of subscription game services, like a Netflix, you know?
Yeah,
they change their business model all of a sudden because they have, you know, this opportunity to avoid potential bankruptcy because of what's going on with the stock. That changes the entire framework of which the value of the company is. Now, will they do that? I don't know. And again, I don't even really know how you could change their business model. But let's say they did do something like become the Netflix of gaming. That changes how you look at the company, right?
Of course. No, I think the better case is AMC, like you mentioned, but all this, it does kind of beg the question, like a lot of these, and this is the, I think, especially the value folks that eschew growth stocks for this reason is there, you know, the fair value, like there, it is hard to get a real gauge of it. And ultimately it just comes down to, you know, what are people buying it? Are there more buyers than sellers? Is there risk appetite? And so it does become a little bit of a macro type of thing.
Exactly. Well, growth and value are certainly different in the way that you approach them. Anybody who is a growth investor knows that what you bank on is the growth rate, not the current earnings and not the current PE. You're looking at the future with them, whereas value stocks are more mature companies and you're looking at the value of their assets. And so, you know, growth investors and value investors look at stocks in very different ways.
Right.
And you got to consider that when you're making decisions.
Right. But you do think that economically and in the market, like everything is, we are in a good enough position, like rising yields don't concern you. that much. Potentially the Fed may be tightening at some point. What I see, Bill Gross just said they would do it next year or something, but not that he necessarily.
I have heard that in the Treasury, the 10-year moving upwards suggests that the market's pricing in a 50 basis point right. increase in 2022. The Fed has said that there will be transitory and that they're basing any rate hike on employment. Employment's a lagging indicator. Keeping that in mind. So if that's really what they're going to, they'll probably tighten too late. But I just don't understand people freaking out over tightening, right? Because think about the entire tech bubble of 1999 happened during a rate hike. Five rate hikes in that period, right?
Yeah.
Everybody gives me a lot of hassle on Twitter for saying this isn't like 99. Don't remember that the macroeconomic backdrop was drastically different back then. You were like six hikes into a rate hike cycle when the bubble burst. You were in a economy that had been chugging along pretty hot for a while. And that's so different than coming out of an economic downturn.
Right.
So different than coming out of an economic downturn.
And
so, you know, from that perspective, rate hikes don't freak me out. Rate hikes mean that the economy is running hot and you're trying to keep things in check, right? You also see better lending, more lending when rates are like a little bit higher. It's just, I would say the entire and almost everybody who's a professional in the markets today has never seen a rising rate environment. Because the last time that happened was like
the early 70s, 2000s.
Right? No.
Oh, you mean that?
I mean like legitimate trend, long-term, rates are going higher over time.
You're right.
Interest rates have been going down from the 70s. And I would argue there's nobody that's a market practitioner right now that was, well, I don't want to say nobody, but a very, very small percentage of the people that are professionals, investors right now, were professional investors in the 60s and 70s.
Right. Yeah, those are all certainly valid points. And also the one that, you know, the interest rates, and if we're going back to 99, they weren't zero, they were 5%, right? Or five and change, and then went up to six. And there's another point I was going to make here about that, which I have now forgotten. So it must not have been that important. But this does kind of lead into the next thing, which is another area that you're bullish on, which is financials. So talk to me about that.
So financials in particular are very sensitive to interest rate changes.
Yeah.
Very low interest rate environments are very hard for financials, especially mid-cap and small-cap regional banks kind of thing, to make a lot of money because they have no spread. Right? They have no spread on their investment. They're not paying much in terms of savings rates, but they also can't charge much in terms of lending rates. So they're really not making a ton of money on lending. So they're not inclined to lend much, and they tend to do other things in an effort to improve margins and be profitable. The best environment for banks is when rates are high enough that they can make a nice margin. If they're too high, then people don't really want to borrow, and so on and so forth. But there's like a sweet spot for banks. And if rates start to go up and get to the 2-3% mark, which is substantially higher than they are today, that's positive for banks. But any trend upwards is going to improve bank margins from where they stand today.
And banks have had quite a run recently, like even over the last year, along with everybody else. So it took them a little while longer to get started.
Banks and energy started to turn the corner in the fourth quarter of last year.
Right. But you still think there, too, that there's room to run.
Well, they're both down. Financials on a one-year basis are basically flat, and energy is still down double digits.
Right. Okay, fair enough. Well, I know my other point here now that I was going to make or ask you about when it comes to rising interest rates, is that one thing that it does bring, like you mentioned, like higher costs of borrowing. And wouldn't that be a concern for some of these tech companies that many of them are their balance sheets in good enough shape where they don't need to?
If you look at most of these tech companies, they don't have a lot of debt.
Right.
They don't need it. They've been able to raise capital through equity or through reinvestment because their profitability and growth is very high. Most of these tech companies have pristine balance sheets.
Hmm.
Not all of them, but most of them.
Okay. Do you have any views on SPACs?
Do I have any views on SPACs? Yes. SPACs are obviously all the rage. They're basically just IPOs in a different form, right? So I think what you're seeing now is people wanting to get into SPACs before they invest in anything, because obviously that's when you want to.
Mm.
And that everybody and their mother are creating SPACs to raise money to invest in something, which is typically when bad investments are made. And if you look at SPACs in general, they have horrible performance track records. Mm. I think the reason you've seen that change is because now you've seen a lot more high profile companies going public via SPAC, SoFi, DraftKings, two really well-known examples. Lots of companies are choosing to do SPACs instead of the traditional IPO process. And in many ways, that's actually positive for the general public in terms of accessibility to IPOs. You know, the traditional IPO process, getting shares of an IPO is like virtually impossible for the average investor, right? You got to be a client of one of the investment banks that's doing the underwriting. You got to express interest. Then the investment bank decides whether or not you're worthy by looking at the assets you have at the firm, blah, blah, blah. And typically the only people who get IPO shares are the big institutions. Mm. It's just, that's the way it is. Mm. Those are the only people that really gain any of the benefit from the IPO process, because when they go public, they usually, you know, especially more recently, have a ton of interest, people that want to get shares of it and they're willing to pay anything for it. And those people make a ton of money. Mm. But the vast majority of investors are left out of the process and get stuck paying the super high premium if they want to get shares, because they got to buy them in the open market. So the SPAC process sort of eliminates that, because anybody can invest in a SPAC. The problem is now you got kind of like in 99, a bunch of people using SPACs to go public, and these are not good companies. They're just taking advantage of this opportunity. I'll give you some numbers that might blow your mind.
Okay.
But last year, there were 299 SPAC deals completed for a total of about $98 billion.
Hmm.
And that was in 2020. And those numbers are more than if you combined all the other previous year's SPACs deals combined. It's more than
that's nuts.
So we are 2.5 months into 2021, and there have been 304 SPAC deals for a total of about $92 billion.
Wow.
Almost, we've done more deals in 2.5 months this year than we did in all of last year, and last year was a record year. Now, we haven't done the total amount is slightly less. It's $6 billion less.
No.
But I would argue, you know, obviously you passed that number. So you think that just tells you how overheated the market is. And it was interesting. I was watching CNBC the other day, and one of their guests was talking about this. It was like worldwide exchange. I was doing mornings with Maria, and I had to get up at 3:30 because I got to do my sound check and audio check at 4:30 a.m. my time. And I got to be ready. So I was up super early. I was watching Worldwide Exchange because there's literally nothing else on. Like, that's going to be helpful for me in talking about the markets, right? Like, I could watch some infomercial, but whatever. So I'm watching Worldwide Exchange, and they had a guest on, which I thought made a really interesting point. Bitcoin is up about 80% in the last year. And a lot of people have become Bitcoin billionaires, right? But there's tax consequences to those gains. So a lot of Bitcoin billionaires are looking for ways to take some of their gains and invest them in other things. And they're choosing to do it in speculative ways. And SPACs is one of those areas. Some of them are starting SPACs because now they have money and interest, you know, to create their own SPACs. Some of them are doing the NFT craze is just blockchain digital art. So they're using the blockchain to invest in a different way. But a lot of this stuff is being fueled by people having huge gains and not knowing what to do with the money. And a lot of it can be tied back to these people who were early investors in Bitcoin, who have made ridiculous amounts of money as a result. Not all of it, but a lot of that speculation kind of drives from that. And also, you know, taking advantage of the average American has 23% savings rate right now, and they're not spending, traditionally speaking, a lot. If, you know, not getting too technical here, but M2 is up like 30%. Right. But the reason you haven't seen inflation is because nobody's doing anything with money. It's just sitting in savings accounts. And while there's really no way to know this for sure, I would say that it's a safe bet that a lot of people are putting that money into the stock market. Mm. They're just looking for places to invest, right? Like, there's so much money. The average U.S. savings rate historically is like 5.7%.
Right.
And it's 25. And it's not that people, you know, people want to make something on their money, but they just don't want to spend it because they're financially insecure.
Of course. Well, where does this all end? I mean, eventually you figure, I mean, there's got to be some risk taking, obviously, but.
Well, there's a ton of risk taking.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way at this point when everything's going up exponentially, right? You got to take more and more risk if you want to beat the market, if you want to make more money, and people, people are essentially almost gambling.
No, we can and, say and, they are.
Like gambling. Yeah. I mean, I say this so often. There's a reason David Portnoy is sort of the poster child for this movement. But yeah, I mean, there's a gambling element here. There's more and more risk-taking happening. The appetite for risk is high. How does this end? I think it ends badly. I just don't think it ends badly in the near term. Right. And I think a lot of people confuse when I go on and I'm relatively bullish about things that seem crazy. Mm-hmm. Right now, I've been doing this long enough to know that, like, just because you know things are irrational doesn't mean they can't stay irrational. There's like a famous saying, like, the markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent.
Yeah. I like to say that the markets can stay solvent longer than you can stay irrational. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, either way, it works. Once you understand human behavior and that people will do things irrationally for extended period of time, you understand that you can stay bullish a little longer. I mean, that's what gets value managers in trouble all the time, right? They always sell too early, right when the momentum's picking up. Like, they're always anti-momentum investors.
Right.
Growth investors are the exact opposite. They tend to be super momentum. And once you understand momentum and how human behavior plays into momentum, you understand that you can stay hot longer than most people think. I mean, how many people in 2008, 2009 were like, treasuries can't go any lower? Like, how many bond managers out there have been burned by treasuries can't go any lower?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, like, even at zero, you can't say that.
Yeah.
And these things tend to go on longer than you ever think they could. Mm. So my big thing is, like, I want to take advantage of the momentum. I want to take advantage of the trends. But I want to be cognizant of risk. And that's where I get into my whole liquid alternatives aspect, where we do a lot of hedging with non-traditional products and investment strategies to sort of mitigate so that we can take more risk. And so I think to be a really good investor in a market like this is to realize the momentum and to take advantage of the momentum and not be afraid of momentum. Mm. I think some people are just afraid of it. But also think about, how do I mitigate overall risk in my portfolio so that I can take more risk in other places where it's more likely to pay off?
Okay. Now, that's one of the things that I saw, I've seen a lot, I'm sure you have too, is that, you know, low risk, high returns, this trope. Mm-hmm. Now, doesn't that kind of fall into that trap? I mean, how do you do it?
It's not that you're taking low risk, high returns.
Okay.
The whole concept, Larry Swedrow wrote a great book on this. And I wrote a white paper in 2008 about this concept. It's smart risk. You're not taking low risk. As a matter of fact, all you're trying to do is be the same risk as the overall market, maybe slightly lower.
Mm-hmm.
You're just picking and choosing ways to build your portfolio so that you can take a lot of risk in the places that are most likely to pay off, and lowering your risk in the places that are least likely to pay off, right? And then overall, you build a portfolio that has a pretty attractive risk profile. Your goal here is to have a really high risk-adjusted return, not low risk for high return. That's not what you're doing. You're trying to have average or slightly below average risk and high return.
Fair enough.
And so you're building a portfolio where you're taking your risk bets smart, right?
Okay.
In a smart way. Mm-hmm. I think, for example, this is a great example that's always been used in every hedge fund of fund alternatives platform. We'll talk about this. Emerging markets are a high risk, high reward area of the market, or have been.
Right? Yeah, traditionally, yeah.
So if you add an equity market neutral 5% allocation into your portfolio, and the argument being equity market neutral is beta zero, if it's done right. Not everybody does it right, but that's what, that's the, this is a theoretical example. I'm not going to say like, this is the fun. I'm just saying like, this is the theoretical example. Take equity market neutral, beta zero. And that now gives you, if you have a risk budget and your risk budget is 100, right? Equity market neutral takes nothing out of your risk budget. But now I might be able to put double the money in EM and not put too much risk into my portfolio because I've mitigated it somewhere else. So a lot of pension funds, this liability-driven investing that everybody talks about, that's what they do. They say, these are my liabilities. These are my assets. This is how much risk I can take based on what my liabilities are. And I'm going to take risk where I have the best chance of getting a good return. And I'm not going to take risks. That's people who talk about passive in large cap. It's because there's very little payoff to risk, right?
Right.
But they're much more willing to be active or do something with a higher risk and say small cap because your potential reward is much higher. And so that's why they do these things. It's right. Because your goal is not to take more risk into your portfolio. It's to be able to take the most risk in the areas that have the best chance of having a big reward without taking too much risk in an area that you'll never get a big reward on.
No, no, I get all that. But a lot of that, it does then come down to identifying what the aspects are that can deliver the higher reward in the future, right? And
well, that's the job of the person managing the portfolio to make that I would like to think like educated guess.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. By building out your capital asset pricing model and figuring out what your expected returns are based on your different inputs and figuring out which areas of the market have the best expected returns. And then looking at the risk profiles of those areas of the markets. And if your expected return isn't that great, but your risk is high, that's not where you would take your risk. You'd look for the places where you have the highest expected returns. And quite frankly, regardless of risk, I mean, that's if you build any sort of efficient frontier, that's what the efficient frontier does, right? It allots you on the efficient frontier by putting you in the, by doing exactly what I'm talking about.
All right, fair enough. Shayna Sissel, I want to take a quick break and come back and talk about some other things that have the markets and the world a little bit vexed at present, but let's first take a short break. If you are a premium subscriber, you do not get the break, so don't touch the dial. We'll be right back. Everybody else, if you want to become a premium subscriber and not get these annoying breaks and announcements and ads, then you can do so and are invited to do so by visiting the website contrarian.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H.
I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarized the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's merckresearch.com, M-E-R-K.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
This is the segment of the show where we ask our guests a little bit about their background, their professional background, how they came to this state of their career and things that went into it. So why don't you take us back and let us know what happened?
Okay. Well, I got into finance by accident. It was not my chosen career path. My undergraduate degree is in sport management.
Nice.
And I grew up in a hardcore, avid sports loving family. And it was one of those things that if you can't beat them, you have to join them. Like if I wanted to like just survive the weekends, like I had to become a sports fan. Like just that's what we did. So I wanted to be a sideline reporter for ESPN or one of the major networks. I did my internship senior year of college with the New England Sports Network, and I got to work with many of their many of the on-air talent there. So I worked with Wendy Nix, and I worked with Kara Henderson, to name a few, some really well-known reporters that people are familiar with on ESPN and some of the big networks. So I wanted to do that. So after I graduated from college, I only had, I was dating a guy and I wanted to be near him. So I didn't want to move. And so the only local opportunity I had in the sports field was with the New England Patriots, working for Stacey James in their media relations department. Don't say, oh dear, I'm a big Pats fan.
Go on, it's okay.
I grew up in New England. My grandfather was an original season ticket holder. I'm not a bandwagon sports Pats fan.
Fair enough.
So that was the offer I had, but they wanted me to work as an unpaid intern for the summer, and then I could be a paid employee in the fall. Obviously, how was I going to do that? They wanted me to work 40 hours a week, but not pay me. How was I going to like survive? So as much as I wanted to take that job, it just wasn't feasible. So I ended up taking a job with a staffing agency because that's what was offered. And one of our clients was Morgan Stanley. And we were trying to get them financial advisors for permanent placement, and we kept sending them people and they wouldn't hire anybody. So my boss asked me to go interview, find out like why we couldn't get anybody hired. They didn't know me. I wasn't the account manager. So I did. And I got offered the job. And so at the time, I was also interviewing for sports jobs. I had broken up. I think we were so on again, off again for so long. But I think at that time, I had broken up with the boy. So at that time, I was like, well, I'll do this for a little while and get the job in sports. And now I was more willing to move. But I ended up falling in love with the markets. And, you know, at Morgan Stanley, when you join as a new financial advisor, they basically lock you in an office for 2 months to study for the seven and then make you listen to the morning calls. And that's all you do. And I ended up falling in love with the markets, which I knew nothing about. And I wasn't a math person. So it wasn't something that like intuitively should have been something I loved, but I did. And so I was a financial advisor for about 3.5 years, but I knew I didn't want to be a financial advisor. Like, I have great respect for financial advisors. It's a very high touch client service kind of role, but there's also an enormous sales aspect to it. And I didn't like that. So I went and got my MBA and then over the years took a variety of jobs, hoping to kind of shift my focus into a more analytical role. I ended up eventually ending up in an analytical role at Fidelity Investments. And then I moved on to Russell, where I worked for their hedge fund to fund. During the crisis, it ended up blowing up, worked for an RIA. And then just over the years, worked in various positions where I was basically doing investment strategy and manager research. I had always thought that I wanted to be a stock analyst. And in 2008, after I lost my job with Russell, I had two job offers available to me after that, and that I had to choose from. One of them was to be a consumer stock on the consumer team covering retail stocks for MFS.
Okay.
And the other one was to be a investment strategist and research analyst for a small REA, where I would continue to do essentially the manager research I was doing, portfolio construction, but also they wanted me to build out a hedge fund alternatives platform. And I would say the job at Russell changed my life and my career trajectory in that it made me fall in love with alternatives. Before that, I was ignorant. I had nothing but negative thoughts about hedge funds and alternatives and, you know, everything that, you know, stereotype you hear about those things. And then my eyes were sort of open to it and I became, you know, a believer. And I wanted to continue doing that. I really loved that. So I ended up taking the job with the REA, which ended up being the right choice because after Lehman blew up, MFS ended up laying off a ton of people, and I probably would have been laid off again. But I had more job security at the REA. That's also when I started doing media. So it was during my time at that REA, I started appearing in the media. The firm I worked for, the founder and president had written a book called Six Sizzling Markets, and he was out doing a book tour, and he had hired Gregory FCA as his public relations firm. And Joe Anthony, who anybody's on Twitter knows Joe Anthony, had just started there. And he was my account manager. He was my dedicated account manager. He's brand new. It's funny because Joe is now the president and he basically runs Gregory FCA. He was my dedicated, he was basically my publicist. And he booked me on all these shows, and it was the height of the financial crisis. So there was a lot of demand. And I was, you know, in my 20s and a female. And so there was a lot of demand for somebody that looked like me that could talk the talk. And so that's kind of where I made my name in the media. There was a time that I didn't do media because I worked at bigger firms and I wasn't, you know, important enough to do that. But that's how I kind of got my start. And it really does play into where I am today.
Cool.
And then just from there, I've built my career, just moving to more and more senior roles, getting more and more experience, you know, running portfolios. I've managed, you know, millions and billions of dollars in former roles at, you know, a variety of different firms for folks. And so that's given me the opportunity I have today, where I'm the CIO of Spotlight Asset Group. And, you know, I would say 50% of my job is being the public face of the firm. So being out there in the media. And so that's kind of, that's my career.
Very cool.
None of it was normal. None of it was like,
yeah, well, what is, right?
I know. Right. Yeah. It was all kind of chance and, just opportunities happening at times.
Very cool. I'm surprised we didn't overlap earlier then, or at least not in a more significant way, because I covered hedge funds throughout the 2000s and 2010s.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's interesting. I love the hedge fund industry. I love the managers, a whole bunch of characters, a lot of fun. But there's very few of them I would actually invest in.
I would agree. I love covering the hedge fund space. Is the most fun. Yeah. The managers can do things nobody else can do. Right. The complexity. There's so much differentiation. Like there's only so many ways that a large growth manager can invest. Right. But like in the hedge fund world, the creativity, the complexity, just the nuance, the different ways they all approach things is so different. And none of the meetings are the same. Way. These are all risk takers. So they just have a different mindset in life. They're fun. And my favorite stories of meetings I've done are the crazy, eccentric managers. And there are plenty of those. But you get to meet some of the greatest investors in the world because the greatest investors in the world don't run. I mean, most of them don't run long only.
They're doing
something different.
I need to be well-versed in a whole bunch of different things that, you know, anything that it could affect any market and provide opportunities for arbitrage.
They're risk buyers. The other thing that I really enjoyed about working in hedge funds, and I think the timing of when I got involved in that industry plays a huge part in why I have such fondness, but I realized really quickly that hedge funds are the canary in the coal mine. Like, when things start going wrong in the financial system, the hedge funds feel it first, and nobody really pays attention to it unless they're in there, because it's usually like the little guys doing the relatively illiquid stuff that start to blow up first and no one cares.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I remember actually back in 2007, it was the Bear Stearns Fund of Funds.
Yeah.
Blew up well before, I think it was
2007. There were a whole bunch of Muni ARB funds that blew up. Bear Stearns blew up. And at Russell, for us, it was a firm called Sagecrest Capital.
I remember the name, yeah.
That was located in Greenwich, Connecticut, and they were an asset-based lending firm. And we had put in a request to redeem our shares before I actually started. But they came back and said they couldn't fulfill because they did not have appropriate liquidity in their markets. Mm. So we gave them an extra 60 days. And after 60 days, there was even less liquidity. Mm. And so this was in June of 07.
Yeah.
June, July of 07. And then the Muni ARB funds started to blow up. Well, then you had the big margin calls that affected large cap value. Do you remember this? In August?
Oh, yeah, right. That was right. That summer. Yeah, sure.
Yep, because all the funds that were short, relatively illiquid stuff were getting margin calls, and what they were liquidating was their most liquid stuff, which was large cap growth and value names. But it was mostly value that got hurt.
Definitely the canary in the coal mine.
And then all the Muni ARB funds started falling up.
Yeah, the writing was on the wall then. That's true. That's true.
All of that stuff happened in mid-07 and in the fall of 07. And technically, the full-on financial crisis where everything just went to hell didn't happen until Lehman blew up, but you had so many things that happened starting more than a year earlier that told you this was going to occur.
Yeah. And, you know, bringing it back to the present day, there's absolutely none of that. There's more than enough liquidity. And so, yeah, so people who say we're close to a meltdown maybe should look at their history a little bit closer.
Exactly.
Nice. And so now tell me about the Black Swans. You just started this last year, right?
So myself and Suzanne Abrams started a podcast called Black Swan. So this all came to be from just a chance encounter at WealthStack 2019. Mm. I was a speaker at WealthStack and Suzanne attended, and so did Danny Fava, who a lot of people know, and Perth Toll. And Perth was actually contemplating having her own podcast. And there was a podcast booth set up at WealthStack. So she had set up with the producer there to go into the podcast booth and just do like a test, right? So it was me, Danny, Suzanne, and Perth. She was like, just come in there with me. We'll just kind of mess around. And we had this really cool conversation with Danny. Like Danny was the person we were interviewing. Perth was just like, come in and do the interview with me. And then Suzanne ended up joining us at one point. And I remember saying, like, wouldn't it be cool to have like a female focused podcast, not focused on female issues. Right. Like that's not what we wanted to do.
Right.
That was not my idea. My idea was, why isn't there any female hosts that that have female guests that just talk about markets? Right. Because, you know, there's so many smart women in this industry and nobody ever invites them on the podcast, and there's not a ton of female hosts. And then the female focused finance podcasts out there are just really about being a woman in the industry and talking about, you know, changes have to be made. And there's definitely a place for that. But I like to focus on highlighting and the positive things and just showing that women are smart. You know, there's that whole cliche, if you see it, you can be it.
Sure.
And there wasn't enough of that, in my opinion. And so we just kind of said it. And then I put out a poll on Twitter right after and was like, should we start a podcast? And it was like 90% of people were like, yes. And then I talked to Perth and it was like, it was supposed to be me and Perth. And then Perth was like, I can't, I'm so busy. I just launched this new ETF, the Freedom ETF that she has. And she's just like, I just don't know if I have the time. Suzanne was super into it. And she was like, I will do it with you. Nice. So I said, okay. So then we started talking about it. And then my firm at the time was like, no, you can't do it. You can't do it. You know, if you do it, then we have to let other employees do it. And then we have to monitor it. And we don't want to do it. It's too much work. So at the time I was like, sorry, Suzanne, I can't do it. And she was like, that stinks. I really want to do this. And then around this time last year, as a matter of fact, a week and exactly a year ago on March 23rd, I was let go from my previous firm. My current firm was much more amicable to me having my own podcast. Nice. So then we decided to officially launch the podcast as soon as I joined my new firm. And we recorded our first episode with Perth in like April or May.
Yeah.
We had to get it up and running. We had to come up with a name, which and a logo and an idea of where we wanted to go. And then Suzanne had some issues and she had to start her own RAA. She literally started her own RAA so we could do the podcast.
Wow.
And we officially launched, I believe, in October or November.
Mm-hmm.
We had recorded episodes prior to that. As a matter of fact, our second episode with Carrie Mantha, we recorded twice because the original episode was so dated because everything had changed. It was a COVID episode and we recorded it originally in May or June. And then, you know, by November, the entire thing had changed. So we had to re-record it. But that's when we launched. And you know, we've tried to put out an episode weekly. It's been hard sometimes. I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
So we just try to do it with relative frequency. You know, we both have jobs. It's hard to get guests. So usually it's feast or famine where we have like three guests a week and then don't have anybody for a month. So we launched and, you know, it's been well received. But the goal is to just talk about timely things. But all of our guests are women. No offense to the men.
I think that's great. I think that's great because, I mean, I tell you, like, I would have loved to have a female co-host and was kind of looking around for it and couldn't find anybody. And even finding female guests has been a challenge. I have prided myself. The first year I did have quite a few, but it was not easy. And there are some very smart women in the industry, but they are still underrepresented. Do you have any thoughts about that and why that is and how that might, we might change that?
I have a lot of thoughts on why it is. I just don't think young women are encouraged to go into this industry and they don't see a lot of representation. And so if you don't see it, you don't realize it's for you.
Right.
People tend to want to go into areas career-wise where they see people that they can relate to, right?
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of people see me on TV and think that it's some like self-serving aspect to it. But a lot of it is just to be a visible female out there, to be representative of what is possible. And that's the entire premise of the podcast, is to show people what is possible for women in the industry. But I do think it is tough. I think we as women, there's a lot of things that are difficult for us in this industry. And I'm going to say something pretty controversial.
Okay.
I do think that we as women, when we have kids, take ourselves out of opportunity, ourselves. And some of it we can't do anything about. And some of it we could. Who your spouse is matters. In a big way, because there has to be a willingness to allow you to do those things. And I'd love to say that there are a lot of men that are super supportive of you know, super ambitious career-oriented women, but that's not true, unfortunately. Not their fault. I mean, it's just, it feels wrong on a lot of levels, I'm sure. But, you know, in the podcast we did yesterday with Dominique, she said something that there's like this stigma against women saying, like, I just want to make a lot of money and be super successful in my career. Like, women are not encouraged to say that. And I think as a result, an industry like ours, where it's about making money, let's just be honest, that's entirely what our industry is about. Isn't appealing because we're not encouraged to do that. We're encouraged to help people. And I think that is why you see a lot of female advisors, but not a lot of female money managers. Advisory, it feels very like you're helping people, like you're supporting people, like you're caring for people. And so women in the industry tend to be more attracted to those kind of roles than in like the pure, like, I'm just here to make as much money as I can, to make as much money in my portfolio, to pick stocks that are going to win. That just doesn't have the same nurturing quality as you know, being a financial planner or an advisor. So I think that like we are intuitively are not attracted to that area because it's kind of frowned upon for women to be like, I just want to make a ton of money and be super successful in life.
Interesting.
And so there's somewhat of a stigma involved in that. I don't know how you fix that. But I think allowing women to know that it's possible that these opportunities are out there for you and that you can absolutely be in a very lucrative career doing something.
Sure.
Because it's fun and it's challenging. And you know, one of the things I love the most about this industry is it's literally never boring.
Every day is different.
Every day is different and there's always something interesting going on. I mean, GameStop was a perfect example of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a whole drama.
Like my job is to keep up with the markets and know what's going on. Like I was up till 2-3 in the morning following that saga because it was super interesting to me to see how it played out and understanding all of the intricacies of like why Robinhood did what they did. Like all fascinating to me. And so it's always challenging. It's always interesting. It's never boring. Something different happens and you learn something new every day. So it's a compelling career for people who are interested in it. It's just, I don't think enough women go out and talk about how fun it is to do this.
Yeah, probably. Although a lot of what you said could have also been said of other industries that have become a lot more egalitarian over the years. Like, you know, we think of something like advertising. I don't know if you saw that show Mad Men. I like to raise that as a historical example of just how crazy and different things were in, you know, as recently as the early 60s. And now it's I don't know what the exact number is, but it's got to be closer to 50-50, certainly than the financial.
Yeah, but I don't know if it was a male-dominated industry because it had qualities that were attractive just to men. I think women just didn't work as much in the 60s.
Yeah,
I
mean, okay.
The
okay,
female women, the women's empowerment movement didn't really happen until, you know, the late 60s, early 70s.
Sure.
Right, where more and more women worked. When women first went into the workforce after World War or during World War II, they typically were taking, you know, the more mundane blue collar jobs. Like my grandmother worked at a roller skate factory making roller skates while the men were at war to do the jobs. But like during a war, no one cares about advertising. And so, you know, those kind of things, I would argue, weren't necessarily male dominated because there were qualities of advertising that were attractive to men. It was just there weren't women in the workforce to the extent that there are today. But I would argue that creative jobs are more attractive to women because women are tend to be inherently more creative than men.
Sure.
So once women enter the workforce, they tend to be attracted to jobs where there's some aspect of caring or nurturing or creativity involved. The areas where women haven't made a ton of progress are the STEM-oriented places, which are traditionally a little, I guess from an outsider's point of view, dull, like engineering, tech, coding, things of that sort, where you don't have as much social stimulation. There's not as much clear purpose. Women, and there's all sorts of ESG studies that show this, women like to do things and invest in things where there's some greater good or some purpose, right? And so a lot of those jobs don't have clear purpose.
Other than making money. I mean, well, not engineer.
Right.
Yeah, I guess interesting. That's really interesting. But like you said, and like we've said, like there is a lot of creativity to this. And
I don't think people realize that.
People don't realize that.
You know, I think there's tons of creativity involved in investing.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I just don't think people, I don't think we ever talk about that aspect.
And I wonder also if people do get a little bit intimidated, not just women, but everybody about, you know, the fact that they think it's maths based and that it's,
I mean, it is, but it's math in a different way. I mean, candidly, I was never a great math student, but I wasn't great in theoretical math. So like I never did well in algebra or calculus, but geometry, trigonometry, and statistics, I was really good at, because one is like completely applicable in life and like makes sense in like real world scenarios, and the other ones are literally theoretical. So I always joke that I failed physics, but I took advanced astronomy in college at through the Five College Symposium. I went to UMass Amherst, but they have something called the Five College Symposium where you can actually take classes at any of the schools in the five colleges, which is UMass, Amherst, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and Hampshire. Okay. So I actually took advanced astronomy class at Amherst College and college. And anybody who knows anything about advanced astronomy knows it's super physics heavy. Yeah. It was like A++++ in advanced astronomy, but I couldn't pass physics because one had some sort of way of which I could like visualize, and the other was just memorizing, you know, formulas. Yeah. And so I would argue that finance is somewhat heavy math based, but because it's so applicable to like something you're actually doing in the real world, it's easier, at least for someone like myself, to digest.
Oh, really interesting. Yeah. Very cool. All right. Where are you? So you're from Mass?
I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is a city in central Mass. My dad was a Worcester police officer and my mom taught in the Worcester inner city schools. It's very blue collar. It's a city that grew up. Its industry was mostly manufacturing. U.S. Steel had a big plant there. Norton Company, which was bought by Saint-Gobain, built rocket engines for NASA there. It was just a very heavy manufacturing oriented economy until that all kind of went away. And then it kind of has had a renaissance in recent years. It's become a real biotech hub. Pharmaceutical and biotech is huge industry there. Lots of major biotech firms there doing some really cool stuff. Because UMass Medical Center, which is the medical school for the University of Massachusetts, is there. There's a huge biotech boom there, pharmacy. And then Worcester also has a lot of colleges. So Holy Cross, Clark University, Assumption College, Mass School of Pharmacy. So Worcester's had a bit of a renaissance, but it has its issues because of its location in terms of the drug trade. It's perfectly situated in terms of access to Canada. You have to go through Worcester to get to Canada if you're coming from the south or the east to get to, it has a lot of issues because it's kind of part of the drug runway or highway into Canada. So it's an interesting city. It's that I'm really proud of having grown up in. You know, my grandparents, my dad's parents were from Poland, and my mom is Irish and from Ireland. And she was sponsored by my Uncle Timmy, who came to Worcester in the 20s. He was a spy for the Irish Republican Army during the Irish Civil War, and he was held in hunger camps. He was a prisoner of war for quite some time. And then after that war, he kind of had to leave Ireland because of his role that he played. And he sponsored my mom's family to come over. And so she came over when she was 8, I think. And my dad's family came over much younger. Technically, I always say both of his parents were immigrants, but technically my grandfather is not. But I do say that because my grandfather basically grew up in Poland. My great-grandparents met in Worcester and married in Worcester and had my grandfather in Worcester. But my grandfather and my grandmother left my grandfather when my grandpa was like 1 or 2 and went back to Poland until World War I broke out. And then they came back because of the war. But he spent most of his childhood in Poland. So I say he was an immigrant, but technically he wasn't. But my grandmother was. She came to the United States when she was 4.
Wow, wild. Okay, cool. Yeah, Worcester also has good pizza.
It does. It actually has an incredibly good restaurant scene on Shrewsbury Street.
Yeah.
My ex-husband would argue it has better restaurants than the city of Boston does.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, actually, similar to my hometown of New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh, familiar.
Which, we've mentioned one David Portnoy, who, for all his faults, at least he did recognize that New Haven, Connecticut is the pizza capital of the world.
Yes.
So we'll give him that. And
England pizza is special, and I've tried to explain to people that New England pizza is Greek style, at least where I'm from. Pizza in the Worcester area.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought it was the same as, I thought it was just like the Italian, the...
No, most pizza in Worcester, if you hire it, get it from a local pizza joint, is going to be Greek style, which means it has more than mozzarella cheese. It's cooked in a pan and it tends to be greasier. It's not super thick. So it's not deep dish, but it's not thin crust either.
Okay. Yeah.
It tends to be overly cheesy because they use three or four different types of cheese on it. So it's a completely different animal.
Yeah. I like that one too, but yeah, I'm partial to that anyway.
Well, New Haven pizza is, in my opinion, better. The only Italian pizza, true Italian pizza that I think is good is the Neapolitan pizza.
And right.
Anybody who's had it knows that the only true Neapolitan pizza, if you go to a place that says it's Neapolitan, means they got their oven from Napoli. It's required, if you're going to call yourself Neapolitan pizza, you have to buy your oven from Napoli, only use certain kind of tomatoes from Italy, and get your cheese from Italy. Like, that kind of pizza I adore. But I could do without, you know, New York styles. And I'm not a fan of Chicago deep dish.
Interesting. Which is where you are now. So
yeah. I will say Detroit style pizza is underrepresented and extremely good.
What does that mean?
It's made on focaccia bread. It has the cheese, the sauce on top of the cheese, but it, not like in the way you're thinking. It's kind of like drizzled halfway. It's square. It's thick, but super light. It's so good.
It's actually I've never had it.
If you can find Detroit pizza, I tell you, it's worth trying.
All right. Okay. And you're going to stay in Chicago for the time being, you think? Or you're gonna, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I'm here for the long haul. You know, this is where my son calls home. I have a great job here. I have some family here. But I get back to Boston very regularly.
Nice. Very cool. Awesome. Well, Shayna Sissel from Spotlight Asset Group, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Podcast, the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. Fascinating conversation. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.